Hello, welcome. It's been a week that's seen mass arrests of students at US universities, 17 days since pro-Palestinian protests began at Columbia. Riot police pulled down the barricades, tents and encampments. Demonstrators have a right to dissent, not chaos, said the president.
There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos.
It's been yet another week where a breakthrough seemed possible in talks for a Gaza ceasefire. Israel is set to have lowered its demands to Hamas and the number of hostages to be released to secure what a leaked copy of the proposal described as a period of, quote, sustained calm. But come what may, Israel says, the Rafah offensive will happen.
We will do what is necessary in order to win and overcome our enemies.
And it's been a week of warnings for world leaders not to look away from events in Sudan and the so-called invisible war. The US is warning a massacre is imminent in El Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. Can anything be done to stop it?
Today, the UN Security Council met to discuss the crisis in El Fasher, which is on the precipice of a large-scale massacre. This is not conjecture.
And it's been the week where the Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez stepped back from the brink of resigning. And after a time out to reflect on what he called relentless personal attacks, he vowed to carry on. Has it weakened or strengthened him? And is toxic politics worse than ever before?
I have decided to stay, to continue with even more strength at the head of the presidency of the Spanish government. This decision is not just a full stop, it marks a new chapter, I guarantee it.
Well, joining me from the International Press Corps this week, let's start with the journalist and filmmaker Paul Moreira. Paul, from PLTV Productions, based here in Paris. And tell us about your documentary that's just been selected for a major festival.
Right, my documentary about crowd control, police and crowd control, has been selected for the FIGRA, which is the major journalistic documentary film festival in Paris, in France, I'm sorry. And I'm very happy about it.
Fantastic. We're going to talk more to you coming up in a moment. Let's cross to Brussels. Let's bring in the author, broadcaster and trained mechanical engineer, Yasmin Abdel-Magid. Your latest book, one of many on Stand Up and Speak Out on Racism. Just give us a sense of that and the stories you're trying to tell.
So Stand Up and Speak Out Against Racism is actually a children's book. It's sort of a 101 handbook on why racism exists and what kids can do about it. But what I found is that adults are buying that book as well. And then Talking About a Revolution is a collection of essays that looks at the politics of the world through a personal lens and through my own experiences. So if people want to, they're all online, so you can get them at your local bookstores.
You telepathically knew that we showed both of your books at the same time. Well, Yasmin, we're also going to talk about your birthplace, Khartoum, and events in Sudan shortly. Thank you. Let's also bring in Nico Hines, seasoned correspondent and now world editor of the news website, The Daily Beast, from London. Nico, your latest story that you're looking at is about Tinder wars between Ukraine and Russia.
Yeah, I've got to watch out for The Daily Beast over the weekend. We've got a really excellent piece from Anna Nentsova, who used to be our Moscow correspondent, but of course it's too dangerous to have a Moscow correspondent these days. So she is often around Europe and often in Ukraine, where she's been talking to people who have been getting involved in the boom in Tinder and dating in Kyiv as people try and take their minds off war, while of course Tinder has now been banned in Russia and the people are still really missing it.
Look forward to reading that. Nico, great to have you with us. Let's also bring in Matthew Dalton from The Wall Street Journal. Interesting day, a UN-designated World Press Freedom Day, and a day your colleagues will be thinking about Evan Gershkovitz. And you're in the midst of a fairly interesting story too right now.
I've been writing about the French government's efforts to suppress anti-Semitic and pro-Hamas speech. So France has pretty strict laws around condoning terrorism, around other kinds of extremist speech. And this week it summoned two lawmakers from two members of the far left France Unbowed party because they are under investigation for making statements that complaints have said from a number of complaints from Jewish groups have said condone the October 7th attack or legitimize Hamas. So the French authorities have been investigating hundreds of people for this offense in the aftermath of October 7th. And it's a really interesting dynamic, particularly for an American journalist, because you know, France has laws that are very restrictive of speech. In the U.S., we have the First Amendment, which pretty much
gives
near absolute protections to all kinds of speech. There are very, very limited cases where the government can intervene. So it's an interesting juxtaposition between France and the U.S.
Really interesting. Matthew, thank you, all of you, to be with us this evening. Well, we begin in the U.S., which has a long history of university protests and a handful of those that go down in history. The most infamous, Kent State, Ohio University, this same weekend back in 1970 over the Vietnam War, the National Guard opening fire into a sea of anti-war protesters and passers-by, killing four young people in the crowd, triggering the first nationwide strike. Jackson State College, also 1970, Mississippi, against racial injustice. Police killed two black students after firing into a college dorm. And then 1985, a nationwide US university strike against the apartheid in South Africa. The demand for campuses to cut ties with groups linked to white minority government. It was Columbia University in New York State, the center of that movement. And it is once again today, the first of more than 50 that's inspired smaller but global movements too. Here in France, the UK, Australia, the Middle East, students bringing classes to an end in demonstrations over the Gaza war. At some, including Columbia and UCLA, it became ugly this week. You can see riot police called in. Well, we saw students arrested, the president intervening, and authorities claiming students have been hijacked by outside elements.
Dissent is essential to democracy, but dissent must never lead to disorder or to denying the rights of others so students can finish the semester and their college education. Look, it's basically a matter of fairness. It's a matter of what's right. There's the right to protest, but not the right to cause chaos. People have the right to get an education, the right to get a degree, the right to walk across the campus safely without fear of being attacked.
Outside agitators were on their grounds training and really co-opting this movement. At their request, we went in and conducted an operation to allow Columbia University to remove those who have turned the peaceful protest into a place where anti-Semitism and anti-Israel attitudes were pervasive.
Nico, let's begin with you in London. The crackdown, how the authorities are handling it, are they doing this right?
Well, it's very interesting to see how the kind of evolution of this has changed over the last few days. Different universities are trying different techniques, some trying to get more involved. You know, some universities were straight away trying to crack down on encampments, saying you couldn't set up buildings. Whereas at UCLA in California, they kind of took a real hands-off approach. They allowed the students to build a huge encampment with barriers and barricades. And then it turned out that they'd given rather too much leeway. And over the last few days, it's descended into absolute anarchy, chaos, people with bear spray throwing wooden planks at each other and people being wounded, and ultimately the police did have to go in. So, you know, there's always a balance in these things, and it's really interesting to watch the way the police try and deal with these situations. You want to, like with Joe Biden, you know, you want to give people the right to talk and to protest and to peacefully perhaps block something for a limited period. But ultimately, if it spills over and people start really hurting each other, then the police have got to step in.
Paul, when you look at what's going on and compare this to big moments of the past, some of them I mentioned, where do you see this heading?
Well, first, added a little technical issue, but I know that one of the points of the debate is whether foreign agents or foreign elements trying to hijack the protest. I've read the very thorough work of the New York Times on the people who were arrested in Colombia, and they found that very, very few people are outsiders from the
agitators.
University. Yeah, foreign or, you know, people who are not students. They're almost 100% students. So that's the first point that has to be cleared. And after, as your commentary was mentioning very accurately, you know, history decides what is right and what is wrong. We will decide in 10 years if those kids had a moral right to, you know, say what is going on in Gaza is not right. And we take the decision to be very visible, very vocal, and sometimes violent, obviously. Obviously, there are some extremists that are mixed with the crowd, and the institution has to protect themselves. But I mean, I know some young people, and for their generation, it's like the thing. It's like, you know, the Vietnam War movement, and it's very important for them. They're facing something that they deem as unjust, and they want to fight it. So we will decide in 10 years what was wrong and what was right, I think.
Yes, I mean, if you were studying, would you be frustrated that your studies were disrupted, or would you be at the barricades?
I mean, I think I would be at the barricades. Also, you know, engineering is tough, so I maybe would have found any excuse. But more seriously, I think that it's so interesting that we're also focusing, because there are over 100 encampments across the country, but the ones that we're talking about are the ones where there's been a really violent response. And not all university officials have chosen to have this really violent, really heavy-handed response. Some chose, for example, the students are asking for divestment from particular companies and so on. Some chose to take a vote on those divestment choices. Some chose to allow the encampments completely. So I think we've created a bit of a false equivalence that the only options are for the encampments to be completely disbanded or, you know, violently, or that's the kind of only situation or the only option for the institution. The other thing I would say is it feels a little bit funny to me to be talking about protests in this way as a really sort of polite activity when we're on France 24. I mean, the French are no strangers to chaotic protests. And I did chuckle when Joe Biden said, you know, you can protest, but you can't have chaos, because that ultimately is what a protest is. It's part of the current democratic process. And so I think there are ways that you can manage a protest in ways that aren't going to harm people long term, but really thinking about what the point of a protest is. It is to disrupt in order to get to your achieved or your stated outcome.
That's really interesting. I just briefly, Yasmin, you mentioned about coverage. We were talking just to our correspondents in Washington a short while ago, Fraser Jackson, who talked about the one of the many peaceful protests continuing at the university there. What have you made of the media coverage, the social media coverage of all of this in the past week? Particularly, I don't know if you've caught any US coverage too.
It's tricky because obviously you want in the media to talk about where the drama is, right? And we know that where there are dramatic scenes of violence between different groups of protesters, between police and young people and students, that's obviously going to make for good footage. But I do also think that we do have a responsibility when we talk about these sorts of things to highlight where the success of these encampments is in order to demonstrate that it isn't one, or not to skew perhaps the understanding of what these protests are trying to do, what these encampments are trying to do. Because as Paul mentioned, I do think that this is a moment this entire generation sees as their moment. They and they also, remember, they've grown up with the BLM sort of protests around George Floyd. They've grown up with January 6th. Like, a lot of these young people, formative moments in their lives have been about mass movement. No mass movement has uniform kind of positions. There will always be people within them that have differing views. But generally, these encampments are about peace and a ceasefire, about disinvestment from particular companies and so on. And so I do think it's worth paying attention to that.
You talk about those within some of the protests. You talked about the ones that are getting a lot of journalistic oxygen. I'm going to talk about one of them at UCLA, where there were violent breakup of protests in the past 24 hours in Los Angeles. Let's hear from one of the students in the aftermath of that.
I was on the front lines. I was, you know, the cops hit me with their batons and they grabbed me. I did not resist arrest. but they grabbed me and I said, okay, at this point, like, the bets are off. Like, the school rather physically intimidate their students, eventually hurt their students, rather than even consider divestment. And that is what's so frustrating.
Matthew Dalton, where do you see this heading?
Well, I think one of the uncomfortable facts about these protests for everybody involved, and particularly people in the media, is that the violence, the chaos, is what gets the headlines and what attracts attention to the cause. And we saw that, you know, for example, in France, when the Yellow Vest protests happens, it had been this kind of slow-burning thing. But then there was one weekend where the things really got out of control, and the government actually responded. So I think that's kind of the dilemma that some of these protesters are facing right now. And I think, you know, this is probably this is not kind of an idle protest, particularly for people in the U.S., because they're protesting against the United States government, which is one of the main supporters of, or the main provider of, weapons for Israel. So these protests are potentially going to have a real impact. They could change U.S. policy. And Biden is under a lot of pressure right now. He's facing re-election, and young people, he needs them to win re-election against Trump. He needs these college students. He can't afford to sacrifice any votes. So there's going to be a lot of pressure, a lot of potential. I mean, these protests could work in terms of changing the Biden administration's position. I think it's something that's going to be really interesting to follow in the next few months as the election approaches.
That's really interesting. We were talking to a protester at Columbia University today, saying that their university is looking at divesting ties with Tel Aviv University. Nico, in London, do you agree that this can bring about significant change?
It's certainly possible. I think what's very interesting about this is that we're having this big eruption of protest at the moment, and there isn't actually very much going on in Gaza. We're in kind of in a holding pattern at the moment. And I think one thing that we're kind of overlooking a little bit is that if Israel do storm into Rafah on this kind of final part of the, you know, their final part of Netanyahu's mission to wipe out Hamas, or whatever he's kind of attempting to describe it as, the reality is that that will be horrific for civilians, people who weren't able to flee, and that we'll be getting much worse scenes coming out of Rafah in a way that has been predicted and forecast, and that we know that, for example, Biden and the other Western governments have been advising Israel against. So I think what could happen next is a really big, big impetus and much bigger protests that will follow if Israel does take that course. And I think that then may well kind of really be the final nail in the coffin in terms of Israel's failure in the PR war. You know, if you think about how the sympathy that they garnered around the world after October the 7th, I think if they go into Rafah and there's a kind of huge global response to that, when we see awful pictures of, you know, children, women and children being caught up in it, that could have a really lasting impact on how the rest of the world sees this. And so I think the protesters are part of that response that will shape the future of the region.
Nico, you speak of Rafah. It was 9 weeks ago. President Biden appeared confident about the situation, not just in Rafah, but across the territory, saying that a ceasefire could be about to happen in Gaza. This is what happened after being interviewed on a chat show in New York. He said this.
When do you think that ceasefire will start, sir?
Well, I hope by the beginning of the weekend. I mean, the end of the weekend. At least my national security advisor tells me that we're close. We're close. It's not done yet. And my hope is by next Monday, we'll have a ceasefire.
The ice cream moment, as it's become known. National security advisor saying that he told him that it would be close. It seems a long time ago. Conflict with a death toll in Gaza increasing by the minute. Well, this week, on-off, and on-again talks appear to have some momentum. This is Antony Blinken, Secretary of State in the US, back in the Middle East, back in Israel, mediation trilogue, Egypt, Qatar, US, meeting in Cairo again this weekend. A leak of the Israeli truce proposal document suggesting the government will lower its demands for the number of hostages released. And two words appear to replace ceasefire with, quote, sustainable calm. Paul, how are you reading the talks at the moment?
Well, obviously, I mean, just to bridge with the previous topic, it's important to know that the PR war of Israel, which is paramount in this war, is very hampered by the fact that, and that's new. It's a post digital revolution war. It's the first digital revolution war where we are nurtured, fed footage, images, films, photos nonstop from the field. It's not the images are not controllable anymore. So we are watching live really what's happening, and this is costing so much to Israel because reality is uncontrollable. Last war I covered in 2003 in Iraq, the Americans could still control a little bit of it. They agreed with embedment, but it was still very controlled. Now it's impossible to control. We see everything on the ground, and so the ceasefire for Israel, it's not only important for Palestinians that they have to survive because they're dying by the thousands. I would say it's also very important for Israel. For me, there's an existential threat to Israel by the fact that their image is going down by the day. And if they don't react and show that they have a real willingness for peace, I think the price is going to be very high for them. Very, very high.
Yasmin, when you're watching this from Brussels and you're hearing the likes of, well, the rhetoric carefully calibrated by both sides, Hamas saying it hasn't walked away, but the talks about this idea of a ceasefire appears to have triggered a backlash in Israel's cabinet. We've got sustained calm is the word being used, and those on the far right suggesting, well, they wouldn't agree to that because previous wars where they've used the term sustained calm have meant that was the end. They want Rafah invaded. What do you see? Well, let me ask you this way. How hopeful are you that this time round we're close to seeing a ceasefire?
I don't know whether I can predict whether it will be this time or the next conversation, the next time we sort of have the right people in the room. But it is clear that there has to be some sort of, there has to be some end to the current crisis. I think the invasion of Rafah is the big leverage point that Netanyahu has at the moment. And bear in mind, you know, his cabinet is extremely right wing. They are not necessarily interested in the idea of a Palestinian state, recognizing a Palestinian state, the kinds of things that will lead to a long-term sustainable solution, if we can use that word, and not sustained calm. I think that's something completely different. When we're talking about the difference between ceasefire and sustained calm, you know, that's diplomatic politicking around language. The big question is whether or not there will be an end to this phase of the crisis so that there can be some sort of change in phase, like we can go to, all right, what does it look like to rebuild? But we're quite far away from that at the moment. And also bear in mind, Netanyahu is protecting himself because the moment this war actually ends, his head is on the chopping block, right? He is somebody who's also in a position now where this is not only just about the Israeli state, but it's about his sustainability as a politician.
It's a really good point, Yasmin, actually. If we just mention this to you, Matthew, you have Benjamin Netanyahu. He knows that a complete, in his rhetoric, destruction of Hamas, ideologically, whether or not that is possible, seems a long shot. But at least to remove those final five battalions or more in Rafah will be seen as the leader who did something to Israelis, which polls suggest they want that to be completed, Hamas to be defeated. But as Yasmin said, he's between a rock and a hard place. Once it's over, what do you think? He's finished politically?
I don't know. He's a survivor. I think history has shown that. I think that, yeah, that the security failures before October 7th punctured the entire aura and his entire political reason for existence, which is keeping Israeli safe and protecting Israel. So, yeah, I think it's he's going to be in big trouble once it's over. You know, but again, going back to the point that others have been talking about, are they determined to invade Rafah? Are they determined to attempt to completely destroy Hamas? That is the kind of fundamental question, whether, and that is the thing that it seems that the Israeli public wants the government to try to do, and what he has said he's going to try to do. Is he going to stick by that? And I kind of also very important is he, you know, is the United States going to put more pressure on Israel than it's already done to stop it from doing that? Are they, is the Biden administration going to do anything about military aid to Israel? There's a lot of people in the, even in the administration internally, I think, who are pushing for that. And there's a kind of older guard in the Biden administration. It's kind of the same older guard as in the Democratic Party. And I think it goes to Biden himself, who wants to stand by Israel. It's a kind of dated position in the Democratic Party and in the Biden administration, but I think it comes actually from Biden himself. So we'll see how that debate plays out in the U.S. as well.
Well, earlier this week, Tuesday, Benjamin Netanyahu issued a statement and said, whatever happens, quote, with or without a ceasefire, the Rafah offensive will go ahead. And then this is what he said a day later.
We will do what is necessary in order to win and overcome our enemies, including in Rafah, in order to secure our future.
Nico, in London, I want to bring in another complication here, because Israeli media are speculating that the government fears there's an International Criminal Court arrest warrant, an ICC warrant, that may come for some government members, included in that Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems, it's very interesting this, because it seems to have come from Israel, this fear. Nobody seems to be reporting it from the ICC angle that these arrest warrants are going to be issued. So I don't know whether it's a kind of paranoia that's creeping through Jerusalem and that has these people on edge. But it's very clear that Netanyahu and his kind of band of right-wing rabble and various different people that are in his coalition are very much feeling the heat of the world watching them. And they realise that they are, if they're not literally going to be on trial at the ICC, that they are on trial at the moment and everybody's watching what they're going to do. And this is where Netanyahu's backed himself into such a corner with Rafah, because, you know, like we've just heard him say, you know, he is saying unequivocally he will go in. So therefore you kind of think, well, hold on a minute, what are we talking about, a ceasefire, if you're literally saying we're going to carry on the war? So perhaps this sustained period of calm will just be to allow people to, you know, allow civilians out of Rafah so that they can go in and complete the military operation. That remains to be seen. But I think this prospect of the International Criminal Court is so, so interesting, because the court has never dared to go after anybody of this kind of strength and this kind of profile. And that's why, in some ways, the court isn't respected by all over the world, because they've always gone after kind of small-time crooks and relatively easy targets. So it would be a really fascinating and high-risk strategy for the ICC if they did try and go after Netanyahu.
Well, in the middle of the news, thank you, Nico, that dominated headlines, US protests, the Gaza conflict. You might have missed this warning from the US on Tuesday, predicting an imminent massacre in Sudan. It's a city called El Fasher.
Today, the UN Security Council met to discuss the crisis in El Fasher, which is on the precipice of a large-scale massacre. This is not conjecture. This is the grim reality facing millions of people in El Fasher in North Darfur. There are already credible reports that the RSF and its allied militias have razed multiple villages west of El Fasher. And as we speak, the RSF is planning an imminent attack on El Fasher.
Well, a reminder of this so far year-long civil war triggered by a power struggle between the leaders of two rival military factions, the SAF, the Sudanese Armed Forces, and the RSF, the Paramilitary Rapid Support Force. The two generals, these two that once stood side by side, well, now, 5 years ago, in fact, they were both involved in overthrowing the three-decade regime of ex-President Omar el-Bashir. Fast forward to now, we have 8 million people displaced, up to 40% of the population could face the risk of famine through the summer. And the International Criminal Court prosecutor of the states talking about grounds to believe that genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity being committed by the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces too. The latest flashpoint is El Fasher, the capital city of North Darfur, where RSF troops are said to be encircling. It is the last remaining obstacle to the domination of the whole region of Darfur, raising alarm about mass killings if the city is taken. Well, let's begin by bringing in the Sudanese-born author and broadcaster Yasmin Abdul-Majeed. Yasmin, just set this into context for us. What's your understanding of what's going on right now around El Fasher, the significance of that within this wider conflict, and what happens if it falls?
So the last time people might have heard about Darfur was about 20 years ago, when there was the Darfur genocide and when the world sort of stopped and paid attention to this western area of Sudan. Now, what we're looking at today is, in the words of some experts, the militia's attempt to complete that genocide. So the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces, are this militia who are essentially an evolution of the same group that committed that genocide 20 years ago, called the Janjaweed. They were formalized by the former president, Omar al-Bashir, into a faction, a paramilitary group, that is now fighting against the Sudanese armed forces. They have taken most of the Darfur, and this area, El Fasher, it was the last city, it was the only place where people in Darfur could come for safety, actually. There was a truce that was drawn up by local leaders right at the beginning of the war about a year ago now. And so literally hundreds of thousands of people from around Darfur came to El Fasher because it was the only safe place in the region. Now, the RSF has effectively surrounded that city. And we're talking a city of almost 2 million people, at least 500,000 of whom have internally displaced from around the region. There is nowhere for them to go. And experts have kind of have said this is essentially what's called a kill box. The official sort of language for what has been set up now is a kill box, where about 800,000 people are at risk now of a massacre. The Darfur genocide 20 years ago was 300,000. So this is more than two times that. And we're not seeing enough. I mean, it's a terrifying situation. If we want to put it at scale, it's the level of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Like, that's the scale of catastrophe that is quite imminent. We're not talking months and years. We're talking days, effectively. And what the international community, what the Sudanese are trying to ask for is some intervention, whether on the sort of whether it's with the RSF, for example, or on the on those external states supporting the RSF, because this situation, if allowed to continue, would be an absolute catastrophe.
Yes, it's a really interesting point. I've covered conflicts as a war correspondent in Libya, also in Afghanistan. And when you cover conflicts, Paul, you know Libya, for example, warnings of massacre leads to often action or discussion around what to do next. Here we have a situation where there's a warning of a massacre and, well, are we going to talk in a few days about, massacre happened and nothing was done? What's your reading?
And I think today, two people from the Red Cross were killed. So that trying to get into El Fasher. So that gives you an idea of how tight and dangerous and violent the situation is.
Yeah, it's been called the kill box.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I've never been to Sudan, and that's one of my shames that I don't know more of Sudan. But I know a situation that you can parallel with is Eastern Congo. In Eastern Congo, I've seen the blue helmets being deployed on the field to stop the killing between
UN
various, the UN peacekeepers, between various armed groups, some supported by Rwanda, others were Hutus. And they weren't doing anything, really. Basically, they were staying in the bases. Anytime they would be fighting, they would remain on their bases and won't take any risks. So now in Sudan, it's the next level. We haven't even sent anyone, any witnesses. This is going to happen without witnesses. And we know that when you don't have witnesses, the worst will happen. There will be dragons. And no, it's really terrible, terrible.
There will be dragons. Well, let's talk about a situation within Darfur. It's a refugee camp called Zamzam, where given the lack of food and aid able to get in, there are reports of people eating leaves and in some cases soil. This is according to the Reuters news team who've been there in the last week, who've interviewed a number of displaced refugees.
أولاد خالي بيطلعوا بيمشوا جنب المدرسة جنبنا بيقطعوا ورق الشجر بيجوا بيعملوا بيأكلوه لأنه بكون ما في حالي يعني ما بنكون عارفين إنه نحن هنلقى للفطور ولا لا.
Yes, I mean, the Reuters team talking about they didn't believe that people would be eating soil until they saw it for themselves. Tell us about the stories you're hearing, friends, contacts, those living in the middle of this, the type of existence they're living right now.
With you, I think part of the challenge is also that we're not hearing that much from the ground because much of the region has been cut off. There's been a telecommunications blackout for almost months. My own family that is still in Sudan, I can only hear from them, you know, once every few weeks when they find access to, interestingly, Starlink satellite communications.
So, Elon Musk's communication network.
I never thought I would be thankful for Elon Musk's satellites, but here we are. And so it, because, you know, Paul was talking earlier about one of the challenges Israel faces is the fact that we're getting all this live imagery from people on the ground. I think one of the challenges Sudan faces is that there is almost no imagery from people on the ground. And we're talking, you know, not only catastrophic hunger and people, and again, experts are warning of famine. And I don't know if people can conceive what it's like to be so hungry for so long and the kind of impact that has over generations, but also the kinds of stories we're hearing about sexual assault used as a weapon of war. We're talking about many, many, many stories of people who are unfortunately having to birth the children of their rapists and so on. The war has gone on for long enough now that that is the situation. And so I find it very challenging to try to communicate the scale of how bad it is when people have no concept of Sudan beyond, you know, a few images here and there, no concept of what it's like to be that hungry, no concept of what it's like to be displaced over and over and over again. Again, the people in El Fasher right now, even if they move to find somewhere safe, this might be the second, third, fourth displacement. I mean, at this stage, really, Sudan is in a situation, and Sudanese people are in a situation where the very basics are what they're desperate for. They're desperate for running water again. They're desperate for electricity. They're desperate for telecommunications. What I will say, I'm always keen to have a note of some optimism, is that the people, there is no functioning state, but the people that are actually helping are the emergency response room. So across Sudan, there are these groups of volunteers, and they're all volunteers who've come together to essentially create a welfare state. And so they feed, you know, they find ways to feed tens of thousands of people. They find ways to give people access to small education, to games for children and so on. And these emergency response rooms, they've even started to form somewhat of a governance system amongst themselves. And one of the challenges, I think, or one of the things that I really hope happens, is that these emergency response rooms, these grassroots community movements, they are involved in any civilian peace process that happens, because it can't just be those with guns in their hands that are allowed to be at the negotiating table.
No, it's called the Forgotten War, the Invisible War. It's something that we won't forget on France 24, and we'll keep you across developments, especially around El Fasher right now. From the conflict in Sudan, the situation in Gaza, the protests, one other story that's happened this week, live on Monday, midday, in Madrid, Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez announcing a decision he'd made on whether to stay or go in a job he said left him questioning, was it all worth it?
I have decided to stay, to continue with even more strength at the head of the presidency of the Spanish government. This decision is not just a full stop, it marks a new chapter. I guarantee it. If we allow deliberate hoaxes to dominate the political debate, the consequence will be that we will have done irreparable damage to our democracy.
So the context here, years of what he called unfounded, hateful harassment of him, his wife Begoña from the Conservatives, the far right too. After stepping back for 5 days, he made his decision and, coming to his defence, the film director Pedro Almodóvar, in a newspaper editorial, he claimed, well, the opposition, he said, had no relationship with actual politics. He called the technique cruelty based on personalised psychological torture, complemented by misrepresentation and manipulation. So we're talking about underhand tactics. We're also talking about, for example, calling his wife, according to rumours led by some on the far right, operating a string of sex clubs involved in Moroccan drug trafficking. The Guardian saying that this is a new style of toxic politics. Nico, in London, is this worse, toxic politics, than it's been before? Or do we just have a bad memory?
Well, you can go back a long way in history and find politicians, you know, murdering each other and beheading each other. And, you know, there's a long, long history of people doing extremely nasty things to each other. So I think it's slightly silly to pretend that it's worse than ever now. However, we do have a new problem, which is this kind of online troll sphere kind of hatred. That is just bubbling up absolute nonsense where, you know, people, whether it be state actors like the Russians, for example, seeding stupid rumours, or whether it just be people sat in the basement of their parents' house coming up with these ludicrous ideas. And we've seen them particularly directed towards women, I think is one of the strong trends here. You know, whether it be President Macron's wife, whether it's Sanchez's wife, or you've seen other politicians who are women themselves, Sarah Marat. You know, it's like there does seem to be a kind of misogynistic element to some of this as well. And I think you know, what Sanchez has done is a kind of interesting way to try and kind of do a fire break on this. But I think there's also a danger that you're actually feeding the trolls.
Feeding the dragon.
By giving them this oxygen. What we really ought to be able to do is ignore all this online nonsense and just concentrate on the real politics. I think promoting it and making out that it's impossible to go on is potentially a mistake.
We can wish, Matthew, I want to give you the last word. We've got about 20 seconds on this, but do you think Sanchez has strengthened or weakened his position now?
Well, I think he's, I mean, all told, he's probably weakened his position. Because once you kind of cross the Rubicon and say you kind of raise the possibility of stepping down, it's once you pull that back, the suggestion has already been out there. I think it's a little bit difficult to recover from that often. But I think, you know, this will fundamentally depend on what the truth is surrounding whatever accusations there are against his wife, you know, that... kind of just reading about it seems like there's issues about kind of old school.
We're running out of time. Thank you so much, Matthew Dalton, Yasmin Abdul-Majid, author, broadcaster. Also tonight, we've got Nico Hines in London, seasoned correspondent at Daily Beast, and Paul Moreira, PLTV, based here in Paris. Thank you all for coming. Join us next week for The World Next Week.
Canarios, que estamos hartos de ser ciudadanos de segunda y de tercera. Estamos hartos de la masificación, de maltrato institucional, de tener sueldos bajos, del patrimonio destruyéndose, de no tener casas para vivir, de que las tierras las compren los extranjeros porque tienen más dinero para comprar las tierras de nuestros abuelos que nosotros no hemos podido comprar.
La isla está bastante saturada, nos estamos viendo con que están invadiendo prácticamente las viviendas vacacionales nuestros pueblos, lo que está haciendo es que sube el alquiler, los jóvenes no podemos emanciparnos y cada vez lo tenemos más difícil. Vemos cómo se está, por parte del turismo, se está destrozando nuestra biodiversidad.